Am I on? I am. Right. So we've been looking on Sunday mornings, last couple of Sunday mornings. I've been introducing this new series that we're doing. It's fallen to me to do the first three in the series just by a quirk of programming. So you will have a different voice soon. Don't lose hope. I'm going away this week, so you can breathe a sigh of relief. But we're carrying on with this series in Exodus, which is fantastic. I'm really enjoying it, and it doesn't really matter whether anyone else is. I'm having a great time in the book of Exodus. Very, very challenging and stimulating at every level. And if you remember, we left the story last week with Moses having been born, having been threatened by the Pharaoh at the time, and having been saved by his mother by setting him adrift in a little ark on the River Nile. And he was discovered, if you remember, by Pharaoh's daughter and taken into the palace eventually and raised as an Egyptian prince, son of Pharaoh's daughter. And we pick up the story in chapter 2 when 40 years have passed. So if you just... 40-year-old man now, not a baby in the bulrushes anymore, okay? So one day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. And when the girls returned to rule their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Rule asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him home to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man, who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I've become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. That is the end of chapter 2 of our story of the Exodus. Starts with Moses being taken into the royal courts of the Pharaoh, the main ruler of Egypt at the time. Very powerful, viewed as a god. Moses was taken into his household and treated as one of his sons. We're told in the book of Acts, where we have a bit of reflection on this story, that at the time that Moses was born, he was no ordinary child. For 3 months, he was cared for by his family. But when he was placed outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him in and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. Imagine that. This is a slave boy being brought up in the palace and educated with all the wisdom of the Egyptians. What an education to have put at your disposal. And he would have learned all kinds of things, all kinds of stuff, some of which was probably good, helpful advice, some of which was possibly very unhelpful and certainly different to what his Hebrew upbringing would have taught him. So he had an education that was not based in his own people group and the way that they thought and believed. One of the things that Moses would have learned, for example, would have been about all the gods that ran life in Egypt. There were a lot of gods in Egypt. Here's just 20 of them. I will test you at the end if you can remember their names. There are a lot of gods in Egypt. They all had their own names and their own responsibilities. They were responsible for running different parts of the country, for education, for it's a bit like having government ministers, really, for the underworlds. Osiris was the god of the underworld. Amon-Ra was the chief god of gods. So there were all kinds of gods, and Moses would have learned who all these gods were and what they were responsible for and how to worship them. He would have been told all of that as part of his education in all the ways of the Egyptians. So although he was a Hebrew, he was formed in a very different way of thinking. He was educated very differently to the way he would have been had he remained in the Hebrew camp, as it were. And it set me thinking about the way that we are educated in our own culture, in our society, and the way that our children are educated in our culture today. What are the things that they are and we are being taught? What are the basic beliefs that our culture and our society run on? And I want to suggest to you there are at least three basic beliefs. There are lots more, but these I think are very central to the way our culture works. The first is that we have no reliable bearings from our past on which to build our lives today. We have to invent ourselves. We have to work out who we are and who we want to be. A lot of this thinking goes right back to the 19th century, which, looking around, I don't think anyone can quite remember the 19th century. But a philosopher called Nietzsche, who came up with this great idea that there are no such thing as facts. What he said was this: everything is interpretation. Against those who say, well, there are only facts, I say, no, facts are precisely what there is not, only interpretations. In other words, two people, three people looking at the same thing will come up with different views of what that thing is, and that's okay. There is no real truth in the thing they're looking at itself, but all we have from the past, history, is just different people's views of what happened. There's no reliable bearings anywhere in the past. There's no truth that's been handed on to us that we have to receive. We have to decide for ourselves who we want to be. And whether that's just at the level of career, or whether it's at the level of gender, or whatever it is, we are these days encouraged to believe that we can make the choice, because anybody else who's trying to tell us what we should be is just trying to dominate us and control us. There's a whole lot of beliefs that creeped from Nietzsche into the 20th century into some French philosophers who launched a movement that is now called postmodernism. Some of you may have heard of that word. And one of the great beliefs in postmodernism is there is no big story that governs our lives. If anyone tells you there is a big way of living, there's a whole truth about anything, they're trying to control your life. Don't believe them. And so one of the things that has leached into our life is this radical skepticism about anybody else telling us anything is true or right. We have the thought that I've got my truth, you've got your truth, and there's nobody to arbitrate between us. If you want to believe it's true for you. And all of this is the way that we are taught to believe. We're skeptical if people try and impose a view or a belief on us, even about who we are. So all we are just individuals trying to work out how to be the best human being we can be. That's a hard thing to do. That's a hard thing to do from scratch. Work out who you are. Another belief in our culture is there's nothing in the future. This life is all there is. Between your birth and your death, you've got to have it all, because there's no chance of having it anywhere else. You've got to enjoy life now. You've got to live for the moment. You've got to do the best you can, own what you can, enjoy what you can. And once you cut out any notion of life beyond death, or any certainty about life beyond death, that's true, isn't it? This is all there is. So why not live, eat, consume, be happy? But there's a lot of pressure in that. If we've got to make sense in these few short years that we live, if we've got to get all the pleasure, all the enjoyment into this, it just breeds a culture of materialism and consumerism and hedonism. Let's just live for pleasure. Let's try and acquire and get stuff so that life makes sense and we feel fulfilled as human beings. It's a very pressurized way to live. The life of consumption and acquisition. And the third dominant belief that I see in our culture is that there is nothing above. There is no God. There is no one out there. This is one of Nietzsche's, to go back to him, most famous sayings. God is dead, he concluded. He himself was influenced by a philosopher from the beginning of the 19th century who had a long name starting with S. And he concluded that not that God created mankind, but that humankind invented God. He said that actually God was like when human beings wanted to find something, they looked down a big well and they saw their own face reflected back up at them, but they thought it was something other than them. They thought there was a different being down there because they saw a face coming back. And they came up with this idea of God as a sort of comfort that we're not all alone in the world. And that idea of Schopenhauer fed into Nietzsche's fed into our culture today. There's no certainty about there being anything or anyone out there. Atheism is rife. Not everybody's a rampant militant atheist, but not so many people today believe in God. Certainly not a God with any kind of name or definition. And that just leads to moral relativism, because if there is no one above us, then it's just up to us to believe what we want to believe. And who are you to tell me what to believe? And who am I to tell you what to believe? And we've all just got to work out what we believe, and we've all got to rub along with people who believe something completely different to us. And we're back where we started. Anything is true if we want it to be true. Believe it, and it must be true, because it's true for you. And we're trapped in this world of sort of relativism and consumption. And actually, I believe that we as human beings are not created in such a way. We don't have the capacity to make these big choices. We don't have the capacity to work out who we're going to be. We don't have the capacity to work out what's absolutely right and wrong. We don't have the capacity to do enough in our lives to feel fulfilled. And so what these great big beliefs in our culture create is a deep sense of anxiety. Because we can never be enough, and we're never sure we're being the right thing, and we can never have enough, and we never can be quite sure that we're making the right decisions. It leads to anxiety and stress and even depression. Because we're trying to live beyond ourselves, making decisions that we are not equipped to make, and make judgments that we're not equipped to make. Now, you might disagree with my analysis of the world, but I think that if you reflect on it, you'll see at least some grains of truth in there. When Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, he was educated in a very different worldview, a different view of the world than the one his Hebrew upbringing would have given him. And when you and I are educated by our culture, and when our children and grandchildren are educated by our culture, these beliefs are dominant in our education system. Even if they're not taught it, it's implicit. It's assumed that there is no God, there is no life after death, and there is no past you can rely on. It's a very difficult way to be human, actually, as our culture is finding out. Now, the interesting thing about Moses is that despite the fact for 40 years he went to school in Egypt, we read in the passage we read that one day he went out for a walk. And he went for a walk and he saw what was described as one of his own people being beaten by a Hebrew. It seems that Moses, even after 40 years of education in a very different view of the world, still had a sense of identity that was different to his education. He'd been trained and taught to think certain ways, but he knew deep in himself he was somebody other than what he'd been trained and taught to be. We read in the New Testament, it was by faith that Moses, when he grew up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, rebellious child. He chose to share the oppression of God's people instead of enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin. That's how the New Testament, a bit of information the New Testament gives us. Although he'd been trained, it seems you don't have to live out of your formation. You can choose to be someone different. Moses chose not to be the person he'd been brought up to be, but to identify with what is described twice in the passage that we read as his own people. And I wonder what he learned from being part of his own people and the events that unfolded in the story that we read. Well, one thing, remember, After having killed the Egyptian, been discovered, threatened by Pharaoh, we're told that Moses did a runner. He became a fugitive, fleeing Pharaoh's wrath. And he went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. And he met a young woman, and he helped her with her flocks. And he got taken back home, and he got a wife. Be careful where you sit. Sitting by a well can be a very risky business. I say that because you may know, if you've ever read your Bible, that Moses wasn't the first person to whom this had happened. If you think back a little bit in the book of Genesis, you'll remember that Jacob had a very similar experience. He too fled in fear because his brother was going to kill him. He too sat down by a well. He too met some young women. He too helped them with their flocks. He too got invited home, and he too married one of the daughters, eventually. There's a story in that, but we haven't got time for it this morning. In other words, Moses was, here's a long word, recapitulating. He was living out again a story that had already been told. He was part of a bigger picture. Notice as well where he ends up. He ends up in Midian. Who was Midian? Ah, I thought someone might know. I don't blame you, I didn't know until I prepared this talk. Midian was the son of Abraham. Abraham had Isaac, who became the child out of which God's nation grew, but he had other children through other wives. Isaac got all the blessing. All the other sons got a bit of a blessing and they got sent away. Midian was one of those children who got a bit of blessing, got sent away. No wonder the Midianites were a bit miffed with the Hebrews, given that was their ancestry. So Moses ended up back in Abraham's story. He thought he was running away, but he ended up back in Abraham's story. Notice what happened as well. You remember the story of Joseph? Joseph was a young Hebrew who got sold to some Midianites who took him to Egypt, where he got into trouble and then became prince of Egypt. Moses lives Joseph's life backwards. Moses is a prince of Egypt who gets into some trouble, flees through, and ends up in Midian. You see, what we see in the story of Moses is that we do live in a bigger picture than just the one we create for ourselves. There is something else going on in the world. There's a bigger picture of life. God is in control of events in a way that Moses had no idea. I'm sure that all I've just said would have been news to Moses at the time. He might not have put all those pieces together. But looking back and reflecting on it, we can see that there was a much bigger picture to life than just Moses' experience of being picked on by Pharaoh and running away to a foreign country. That's deeply comforting for those of us who perhaps feel we don't have the resources to create our own life and our own identity, to realize that we're part of a bigger story of God is actually a deeply comforting thing. I'm not just a random speck in the universe that's trying to work out what on earth it means for 70 years and then disappearing into nothingness. I'm part of a much bigger picture and plan of God. Secondly, what Moses learned was when he fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, perhaps it's helpful just to reflect on his journey. So the Israelites, the Hebrews, had been given a bit of land in Egypt called Goshen in which they could live. That was Joseph's gift to them when they first came as refugees. And it's quite a pleasant bit of Egypt, actually, because it's up in the Nile Delta. It's quite green and there's water and stuff like that. So it's quite a pleasant place to live. But Moses flees from Pharaoh. Pharaoh had a number of palaces, and there was one quite near there. It's a bit like the Queen. You know, she's got Buckingham Palace, she's got Windsor, she's got Sandringham, she's got, what's the one in Scotland? Balmoral. You know, it's a bit like, Pharaoh's a bit like the Queen, but younger. And he had palaces all over the place. And so he had one near there, and that was probably where Moses was brought up. And then he runs to Midian, which is in what today we would, I think today, it's Saudi Arabia, isn't it? Saudi Arabia. That's where Midian is. So it's quite a long journey. You've run a long way away. But the really interesting thing about that journey is that the route that's on the map on the wall there is almost exactly the route that most people today believe the Israelites took when they fled as a people and headed towards Mount Sinai in Midian. In other words, Moses, in his personal flight from Pharaoh, was almost, without knowing it again, prophetically living out what would happen in the future to God's people. He was taking the same journey that one day the whole nation of Israel would take through the desert. Almost the same route, people believe. That's interesting because that says that actually God already knows that there is a future. There is something beyond just the random events of a man running away from a vicious ruler. There is a bigger picture again, not just a bigger picture of the past, but now a bigger picture that relates to the future. There is a future that we can trust in and rely in. We're not just here now making it all up. And when we die, that's it. There's a bigger picture. Thirdly, the chapter finishes with God entering the fray. I pointed out last week, if you were here, that the first two chapters of Exodus, God's action is really quite mute. There's lots of stuff that happens, but we're not told that God is controlling the action. We're not told that God tells the Hebrew midwives not to kill the Hebrew babies. We're not told that God tells Moses' mother to put him in an ark. God doesn't appear to be presented as the one who is dictating events. But now, at the end of Exodus chapter 2, suddenly God enters the story as an actor, the actor. He is now in charge of events. It's God versus Pharaoh from here on in, and God's very much on the stage. And this is the point at which God enters the fray. He hears the groaning of the people, the oppression that they're under, and he remembers his covenant. And you might remember that I said when God remembers, it's not that he's forgotten something, but he's choosing now to act on something that has previously been dormant, as it were. Now God is going to do something for his people. Moses realized from this point on, perhaps I shouldn't steal anyone's thunder from next week, but next week there is an exciting encounter between God and Moses. Moses began to learn from this point on that he wasn't just a refugee, he wasn't just, what do you call that? When you run away from justice? Fugitive, that's the one, thank you. Thank you for still being here and paying attention, that's great. He wasn't just a refugee, he wasn't just a fugitive, he wasn't just a failed murderer, he wasn't just somebody with a very mixed up identity. He was somebody who was still part of a bigger picture of a God who is there, a future that is there, drawing on a past that was there, and he is now about to enter the fray on behalf of and with God. There is someone above. Now, if we were to believe some of those stories from Exodus today, we would have a different view of our own personhood and our identity. We know as Christians that we can live with confidence in the past. There are historical truths. It's not just a matter of opinion whether Jesus existed or not. He did exist. No serious scholar doubts that he existed or that he died on what we call Good Friday. There is no doubt that we're part of a bigger story, the story of God rolling through the centuries. And because of that, we can live with a sense of belonging and a sense of identity that we can inherit and receive with gratitude without having to feel we have to make it up. There is certainty for the future. There is more to life than life. There is life that goes beyond the grave. Resurrection happened. There's also many Christian historians who would say, absolutely, there's no other way of understanding the evidence. There is a life beyond this life. We can be sure of that. In fact, if we can't be sure of that, then we might as well shut up shop and go home, because the Apostle Paul says, if we've got no confidence in the resurrection, we're most miserable of all people. If this life is all there is, help! That's my translation of 1 Corinthians 15. We can live with hope, and we can live with this beautiful word, contentment. What a wonderful word. To be content. Not anxiously striving to be someone, to prove we're someone, to possess something, but we can be content because we know that we're in part of a big story which is guaranteed, and we're offered the chance to be part of that forever. And of course, all that only works because there is someone above. We're not left to work out these things for ourselves. We can live with a sense of security, and we can draw on moral wisdom that comes from outside of ourselves. We don't have to make this thing called humanity up for ourselves. We receive it, and we rejoice in it, and we try and work out what on earth it means to be us, yes. But we do it from a place of contentment and security. And if we could live in that view of the world, rather than the one I had on the screen earlier, far from living with anxiety, we would live with deep joy. That's a joyful place to live. Why would we worry about anything? There's a God above, there's a future guarantee, there's a past that's helping us define what we're all about. Jesus was really, really brave in saying, listen, my followers, don't be anxious about anything. I always think that's one of the easiest commandments of Jesus. No, I don't actually. I find it one of the hardest commandments of Jesus. Jesus clearly believed it was possible to live without anxiety. But you cannot live without anxiety if you've bought into our modern worldview. Because our modern view of the world is guaranteed to make you an anxious person. Because you can never live up to it. You can never be good enough, right enough, own enough, achieve enough. So, final thought. Moses, in Midian, got married, had a son. Can you remember what his son was called? Someone sneezed, bless you. What was it? Oh, Gershom. Yes, Gershom, yes. Gershom. Can you remember what Gershom means? It means, don't feel put on the spot. It was a bit like a school moment, wasn't it, really? There. It means, I'm a foreigner in a foreign land. And as names go for children, that's not the most promising, is it, really? When you go to primary school, Jack, Josie, Emily, stranger in a strange land. Oh, okay. Foreigner in a foreign land. That was his child's name, because that was Moses' experience. Moses spent most of his life not belonging. Have you never noticed that about Moses? He spent most of his life not fitting in. He was exiled from his own heritage into Pharaoh's palace. He didn't really fit in there. He went back to his people. They didn't really want anything to do with him because they saw him as an Egyptian. He looked like an Egyptian. Do you remember when he went to the well and the girls went home and said, this man helped us? And the father said, who helped you? And they said, that Egyptian guy. But he wasn't. He was a Hebrew guy, but he looked like an Egyptian. I don't know, did he speak Egyptian? Did he have a funny goatee beard? I don't know what made him think he was an Egyptian, but Moses was always never quite belonging. And then, of course, he goes back to Egypt, where he kind of belonged, and God says, okay, now go off on a journey. Don't put down roots. You're off again. And I wonder what it feels like to be a foreigner in a foreign land. I wonder if that's how we feel about living in our country. I'm English. I live in England. I've always lived in England. I was born in England. And I'm really grateful to be English. I love England. There's a lot to love here. Why would you want to go abroad? Stop going abroad. Enjoy England. It's a beautiful country. I believe this with all my heart, that I have lived one of the most privileged lives that I've ever been lived by anyone in the whole history of the world. I've had healthcare, I've had education free, I've had safety, security, peace, a level of prosperity. I've lived a really privileged life, and I'm grateful to God for being here now where I am. But I don't think that I'm English. I live in England, and I love England, and I'm glad that I live in England. But I know, as a Christian, I am not English. The Bible says that you are not strangers and foreigners, you are citizens along with all God's people. You are members of God's family. That's where my identity lies as a Christian. Paul says we're citizens of heaven, where the Lord Jesus Christ lives. That's where our identity is. That's where our education comes from. That's where our sense of purpose comes from. That's where our hopes and dreams come from. We are not formed by England. Like Moses, who grew up in Pharaoh's palace, I've grown up in England. I've been educated in England. I've learned how to be English pretty well. But in my heart of hearts, I know it's not where I belong. I'm a foreigner in a foreign land. Because I live, and you live if you're a Christian, as a citizen of a different kingdom, God's kingdom. And that means that we're uniquely privileged because we know England really well. But we also know our kingdom really well. And we have a calling then. And the calling is this, according to Paul, to be an ambassador to the land that we end up living in. We live out of the values and ethics of God's kingdom in order that we can be ambassadors to our next door neighbors, our work colleagues, the people that serve us in the shops. We are ambassadors of a different kingdom. Like Moses, never really belonging, in the world that we're in, but finding ourselves there. So the whole sweep of this story ends much later than the book of Exodus, with Joshua, Moses' right-hand man, saying to the people of Israel, you've got a choice to make. You're now living in a new land. You've got a choice to make when you live here. Revere the Lord and serve him in sincerity. Put away the gods that your ancestors served beyond the river and serve the Lord. But if you're unwilling to do that, choose this day whom you will serve. And when we walk out of the door in a minute, that's a choice that will confront us at numerous points this week. Which value set, which worldview will we live out of? Will we live as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven? Or will we just merge back into our Britishness when we walk out the door? Choose this day whom you will serve as you go.